Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Noah Scherr, Chief Scientific Officer at Monovia Therapeutics, is with us to share two generations of mitochondrial augmentation technology, clinical advances in treating primary mitochondrial disease. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm the Patient Support Coordinator at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. The chat section is for you to talk with other families and clinicians who are in the space, but it's really helpful if you can put all of your questions in the Q&A section specifically, so I can keep all of that organized and be able to ask all of your questions at the end of today's presentation. Mitochondrial augmentation technology involves internalizing healthy, functional mitochondria to patient-derived cells to address mitochondrial dysfunction. Monovia has developed two generations of MAT products studied in patients with primary mitochondrial disease in collaboration with Sheba Medical Center. In this presentation, Dr. Noah Scherr, Monovia's CSO, will discuss the promises, challenges, and clinical outcomes of this innovative therapy, providing a comprehensive review of the data to date. This session offers valuable insights for patients, families, and clinicians interested in cutting-edge mitochondrial disease therapies. Without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Noah Scherr. Dr. Scherr is Chief Scientific Officer at Monovia Therapeutics. A molecular and cellular biologist by training, she specializes in developing cell therapies for rare diseases, with expertise spanning bioinformatics, translational science, and clinical stage product innovation. Dr. Scherr has led R&D teams in academia and industry, including design and execution of the first mitochondrial augmentation technology trials for mitochondrial diseases. She holds a PhD in biochemistry from Hebrew University and performed postdoctoral research at the Whitehead Institute and Technion. Dr. Scherr, we are so excited to have you today, and we really appreciate you taking the time to share your experience, your understanding of this innovative therapy with us, and where it's going from here. So thank you so much.
Happily, it's a pleasure to be here, and especially this really exciting time for the whole mitochondrial space with a couple of approvals now starting to come through. So it's really exciting to be here. Let me share my screen, and hopefully that goes well, and then we can get going. I do want to apologize on behalf of Dr. Eladia Kobe. We had originally intended to have this meeting together as a side by side, and he last minute had to go to abroad. So I will be presenting on his behalf, but this is really a work that we did together because he's the clinician that did the trials for both generations of mitochondrial augmentation technology. So the screen's okay?
The screen is good. You're ready to go.
Perfect. Perfect. So Monovia is a company that really was founded 14 years ago with the intention of using mitochondria to do good. When we first started, there were a couple of iterations of mitochondrial-like augmentation technology that as we developed forward. I don't think I need to tell this audience the criticality of mitochondria for nearly every organ system in the body. So mitochondria are present in almost every cell, and therefore, when mitochondria are dysfunctional, we really get dysfunction in every organ system in the body. And when we started to think about how we can treat mitochondrial diseases, and we can't hit everything as a very small company, we thought the bloodstream is a really interesting target organ to begin with because the blood is circulating between all of the organs. And we thought maybe we would see multisystemic improvement, even just touching this one organ system or this one tissue. So, why do we use hematopoietic stem cells for mitochondrial augmentation technology? And I'll get to what that is in just a second. Hematopoietic stem cells reside in the bone marrow of a patient, and they are the cells from which all of the different cell types in the blood are manufactured. So you get red blood cells, you get white blood cells, you get platelets, and so forth. And when you have mitochondrial dysfunction in these cells, you have reduced differentiation ability, so you don't get all of these cell types. You have reduced immune system dysfunction because these cell types don't have enough energy to do their functions. And really interesting, and there's a lot of scientific, especially preclinical data to support this, you get impaired function of additional organs. So if you have even just mitochondrial dysfunction in a single cell type, so just in T cells from the white blood cells, or just in myeloid cells, so platelets or neutrophils or so forth, you actually see that there is muscular and cognitive and cardiovascular and kidney and liver dysfunction. And it's not fully understood what the mechanisms are for that, but we thought that was really interesting. So that maybe if we improve mitochondrial functionality of hematopoietic stem cells, we might get improvement in additional organ systems as well. So what is mitochondrial augmentation technology? The basis of the technology is actually a process that happens in nature. So around the 1980s, it was first shown that if you take isolated mitochondria and put them in a dish in the proper conditions with isolated cells, the mitochondria will actually enter the cells. So like what they did 2 billion years ago when evolution made that first eukaryotic cell, the mitochondria can enter cells. And then they can even, under the proper conditions, rebuild mitochondrial DNA content in the recipient cells. They can restore functionality. They're actually shown both in vitro and in vivo to transfer between cells. And so what we did in the first couple of years of MANOVIA is to A, find a way to isolate mitochondria and then to freeze them so that they maintain their functionality so we can bank them. And then B, find a way to let them internalize into cells. And this is data that's been published in 2021 showing the internalization of mitochondria by those human hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells. So what you see here, the blue is the nucleus of the hematopoietic stem and progenitor cell. It's where the genomic DNA is. The red are the mitochondria that the cell had to begin with, so the endogenous mitochondria, and the green are the mitochondria that have now come in from external. So this is just a visualization of what internalization of mitochondria looks like. And when we started to think about what would be the disease that we would first focus on, we came to Pearson syndrome. Pearson syndrome is a very, very rare disease. It's a mitochondrial DNA deletion syndrome. So the mitochondria has DNA, which is about 17,000 base pairs. In Pearson syndrome, anywhere between 1,000 and 10,000 of those base pairs are deleted in a subset of the mitochondrial DNA genomes that reside in each mitochondria. What you see on the right is a graph of that shows the multisystemic phenotype in Pearson. So almost all patients start with anemia. They present with anemia very early in life. You could see these red boxes here shared by all of these patients. And then with each coming year, an additional organ system might fail. So you have liver issues and kidney issues and ophthalmological issues and cardiac and motor and endocrine and so forth. And it's extremely variable, as you can see, in different patients. That makes it challenging from a clinical perspective to look at follow-up, and I'll get to that a little later on. And the other thing with Pearson syndrome is that the patients do not reach adulthood. So they have a really dismal survival curve. And it's one of the, the saddest things for a physician to tell a patient that they've been diagnosed with this disease. Another important thing to know about this disease is it's not inherited. So as opposed to most primary mitochondrial diseases, Pearson syndrome is not inherited. So the mother's mitochondrial DNA is completely fine. So when we started to think about where we can utilize mitochondrial augmentation technology in a clinical scenario, Pearson syndrome was a good target. Because of the anemic involvement, because it's a disease with no other alternatives, and because of the dismal survival rate. So what is the clinical utilization of mitochondrial augmentation technology look like? And this is the first generation product, so it's MNV101. It was previously called MNVBMBLD for bone marrow cells, BLD, blood-derived mitochondria. The first step is to isolate the patient's hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells. You do that by mobilization of those cells from the bone marrow to the bloodstream, after which you can do apheresis. So apheresis is a process that looks very much like dialysis. You hook up the patient's bloodstream to a machine, and it harvests the white blood cells and puts any other cells back into the body. And then we take those white blood cells and isolate specifically the CD34 positive cells. That's the marker that in humans shows a human stem and progenitor cell. Once we have those cells, we can take mitochondria that we previously isolated from the mother, and incubate them in the cells in the mitochondrial augmentation process. That's a 24-hour process that enables the mitochondria to internalize into the cells, like I showed you in that previous microscopy image. We have methodologies to look at these cells from a point of view of safety and point of view of efficacy. So we know that it's sterile. We know that the mitochondria have entered and so forth. And then once we have tested all of those methods, we can reinfuse that back into the patient. The process takes about 72 hours in total, vein to vein. And one of the important things when we were first developing this was, just as the physicians have their Hippocratic oath that says "do no harm," right? When we were met with a couple of questions of how to implement mitochondrial augmentation technology, that was always our guiding principle. So one of the decisions made when we started to think about which mitochondria to use, we said we'll use the mitochondria from the mother because we don't need to think about questions of do we need matching between the mitochondrial donor and the mitochondrial recipient. One other important aspect is that there's no conditioning happening. So if you are involved in other bone marrow transplantation trials, bone marrow transplantation tends to happen with conditioning of the patients before treatment. So what you do is you try to use either irradiation or some kind of chemotherapy to clear the bone marrow of hematopoietic stem cells, and that enables better engraftment of the cells after the reinfusion. We did not want to do this on Pearson syndrome patients because those conditioning regimens tend to be really rough on patients in general, and specifically rough on mitochondria. And we said we'd rather not see efficacy than have a safety event. And actually, this turned out to be even more relevant in Pearson syndrome because Pearson syndrome is a disease with bone marrow acellularity. So we suspected there would be enough room in the bone marrow to allow engraftment even without conditioning of the patients. Another important aspect of this is why we decided to do the mitochondrial augmentation technology ex vivo. So there's a lot of studies out there in the past couple of years about direct mitochondrial transplantation, and people are injecting mitochondria directly into the bloodstream. What we decided to do, since this was the first clinical trial that ever tested mitochondria as a drug product in patients, was to do this entire process ex vivo. So outside of the body, we take the cells, we take the mitochondria, we meet them with each other outside of the body, and only then bring them back into the patient. And that way we can fully control where the mitochondria are going. They're just going into these cells, they're not swimming around the body. And we can accurately quantitate them. And that was really important to us from a regulatory and from a safety perspective for the patients. So we treated a total of 12 primary mitochondrial disease patients with this product. And the way we started off was we first started with a few compassionate use cases. These were cases that had really critical conditions, and this was before we had a full-blown clinical trial. And one of the things that's important to note, and I know you can probably not see the details of this table, that's okay. We utilized the compassionate use studies to try to get a feel for what are the ways to best measure outcomes in this patient population, and to try to get a feel for which patients we can best help with the therapy. So one of the things, and you'll see this as a recurring theme in my talk, it's really challenging to objectively assess outcomes in such a heterogeneous population. Remember that graph of the different organ involvement in different patients? You can see that in this table here below. Each patient has something else going on. The patients had completely different ages at treatment, so from 2 to 17. They have different mitochondrial deletions, both from a point of view of size and a point of view of the location of the deletion, and a different heteroplasmy level, anywhere from 4% heteroplasmy to 70% heteroplasmy. So the ratio of full length to deleted mitochondria in their bloodstream. And so we want to be able to treat all of these patients, but we really are trying to learn at the very first stage, who can we even help and who can we see improvement in? And so the early compassionate use studies were really a handle for us on, what we want to do going further down the road. So I'll just show you a couple of instances of what we saw in the compassionate use studies. The first patient that was treated was the only patient known at the time in Israel to have Pearson syndrome. And what we saw was a stabilization of his renal function. So you can see his creatinine levels were rising before treatment, and they completely stabilized after. His glomerular filtration rates were decreasing before treatment. He was actually supposed to get a kidney transplant, and those stabilized after. after treatment, and that was stable for a couple of years. So we actually postponed the kidney transplant that he was intended to receive here by another about 5 years. His growth was completely crashing before treatment. So this is a height and weight SDS. It's the standard deviation. It's a little bit of a challenging graph to understand, but basically, the further you are from zero means the further you are from normal for your age group. So he was getting further and further from normal, both by height and weight, and he started to improve in height and weight after treatment. The second patient that we treated with Pearson syndrome was the only patient we had from compassionate use with bone marrow cellularity data. And before mitochondrial augmentation, she had about 20 to 40% cellularity in her bone marrow. And after a year, she had about 40 to 70%. So her bone marrow and the different stem cells and the different hematopoietic cells in the bone marrow were actually getting better after treatment. And actually, we saw improvement in epileptic activity. This was the first KSS patient that we treated. She had stroke-like episodes and epilepsy before treatment. This is her EEG 3 months before treatment. So you can see all of those spikes in the EEG. And this is the same EEG 4 months after treatment. And it was completely getting better. You can see the spike index at a few different time points where the EEG was measured. So we started to get really excited that this treatment can actually have benefit for the patients. And that's when we moved into a clinical trial, specifically for Pearson syndrome patients. And you can see the results of this trial. It was actually intended to be seven patients in the trial. We dosed five patients before COVID hit in. And then that kind of killed any air travel to Israel for further treatment. So our primary endpoint at the time was the International Pediatric Mitochondrial Disease Scale. That's a scale that's both from very, very objective measures that a physician does and also has patient caregiver reported outcomes. As part of the measure. And we saw an improvement in that score both at 6 months and at 12 months. And we also looked at the body weight gain before and after treatment. And for three of the patients, so this one and these two over here, we saw improvement after mitochondrial augmentation. We looked from the IPMDS at where the areas of improvement we were seeing from the patients. And there was a mix of improvement of neurocognitive function and muscle function and coordination and mobility and so forth. So we were really excited that this was improving. One of the challenges, and I think this is important for the patient population to understand, why is progress so slow? Because it's sometimes really frustrating. We've been talking about Pearson syndrome for so long, and we're so dedicated to this patient population. And why are we just doing a clinical trial in Pearson syndrome patient? Why not expand? So that has to do, that kind of comes hand in hand with the regulatory issues. So when you speak with the FDA, you have to demonstrate clinical efficacy by very rigid parameters. And you have to have a measure that's both clinically objective and clinically meaningful. So that impacts two parts of clinical protocol development. One is which indications you can combine in a single clinical protocol. So we had initially had some discussions with the FDA about having a basket trial. So instead of going indication by indication, doing a clinical trial for Pearson and then maybe doing a different clinical trial for Kearns-Sayre syndrome and a different clinical trial for Leigh syndrome or what have you, can we group them all together? The challenge there was that there was no measurement that could be shared by multiple diseases that would prove clinical efficacy. And if you think about it, even looking just at the Pearson syndrome population, it's really challenging to find a measurement that's shared by the patients because of that variability. So the IPMDS that we initially used, the agency did not like because it has portions of the questionnaire that are caregiver reported and therefore they're not objective, right? And they can be impacted by, how the caregiver or how the patient was feeling that day or that week. And it's really difficult to compare something at baseline and 6 months and 12 months where it's just a snapshot. We then looked at anemia. Can we consider anemia as an endpoint, which kind of pops out from this graph because all of the patients are very, or the vast majority of Pearson syndrome patients share anemia. And we initially started out our clinical trial of the new product, looking at anemia as an endpoint. The challenge there was that anemia is known in Pearson syndrome patients to transition to resolve itself over time, irrespective of treatment. So it's the one organ system That's not completely understood why, but it kind of fixes itself in those patients that survive the first couple of years of life. So in a clinical scenario, it's really challenging to prove that if we treated a patient that the improvement in anemia was because of the product and not because of the natural history of the disease. You know, they just improve over time. So that was not a relevant organ system to follow. And what we ended up on is an endpoint involving height, which sounds counterintuitive, right? Because these are the organ systems that are really impacting the patients, right? Who cares about height? So I'll walk you through why we're looking at height right now in our clinical trial. So we were looking for a clinically meaningful and clinically objective endpoint for the clinical trial. And we sponsored a natural history study that was performed at the Children's Hospital at Philadelphia to look at different measurements in this patient population. And we actually looked wider initially. So we looked at patients with Pearson syndrome. We looked at patients with Pearson syndrome that had transitioned to the Kearns-Sayre phenotype of the disease. And we looked at Kearns-Sayre syndrome and actually in a few other SLISMID, so single large scale mitochondrial deletion syndromes. And all of the data from the point of view of a clinical trial, so you're looking at a relatively narrow window, is quite noisy. The one thing that showed continual decline in the Pearson syndrome and the Pearson KSS patients was height SDS. So that same graph of how far you are from the normal height of an age-matched patient population. And you can see in the Pearson syndrome that can go decline quite rapidly. In the Pearson KSS population, that's in orange, you can also see that decline. And in the KSS, it also declines, but we do see sometimes spontaneous resolution, and we do see the decline is much kind of shallower. And I mentioned earlier, why are we looking at height in this patient population? That's not what's really that they don't care if they're a centimeter higher or shorter. We think that height is indicative of multiple organ dysfunction. So if you're anemic, you're not going to be growing. And if you have GI absorption issues, you're not going to be growing. And if you have pancreatic issues, you're not going to be growing, or issues with appetite or weight fullness and so forth. So what we're doing right now is discussing with the FDA, how do we do a natural history assessment that looks at clinically objective measures of those organ systems that we think are involved with height SDS to demonstrate that height is not only clinically objective, which that's right, it's clear, but also clinically meaningful for this patient population. And we think it's clinically meaningful because it involves these variety of organs. And that's one of the, it's just like a single measure that will enable us to see, in different patients with different organ involvements, a change that's relevant to a clinical trial. So I hope that was clear. And if not, I'm really looking forward to questions at the end. This is a really challenging slide to walk you through, but I'll do my best. We looked back, so I told you this was a relatively recent natural history study. It was just published in 2025, so this year. And I should mention this is Rebecca Ganetsky and the team at the CHOP, and they're amazing. It's a pleasure to work with them. So we looked back at the data that we collected at Sheba with Ella Jacoby from the first generation product. And I know I still haven't transitioned to the second generation product to see, would this be an endpoint with that product that would be able to show a difference in a clinical trial setting. So what you see here in the gray is the natural history of Pearson KSS patients with respect to height SDS, with respect to that measure. And just basically, you could see that it continually declines. So it continually, you get worse and worse over time. You're getting further and further from the normal height of your age match control group. And patients who were treated, that's in blue, at least for the first and second year after treatment, seemed to stabilize. So some of the patients actually improved and some of them stabilized, but they didn't continue to drop in their height. And we think that shows that it either improved or delayed deterioration in those various organ systems that involved in each patient. On the graph in the middle, it's the patient as his own control. So instead of comparing the patients to the natural history, you say, well, what did that patient look like before treatment versus after treatment? And so you can see that for the vast majority of patients, except for this patient here, the height SDS trajectory was much better 1 year before treatment relative to 1 year after treatment. I said it backwards, I think. So it's better 1 year after treatment relative to 1 year before treatment. And also, if you just look at, 6 months before versus 6 months after, we were seeing improvement for almost all patients. We do think, by the way, that the durability of effect is lost over time. So you can see here that you got a relative stabilization over a year or two, and then the things started to drop off after 3 or 4 years. So we do think a single treatment might not be sufficient, and you might need to see multiple administrations over time. So that was about the first generation product. What made us move to the second generation product? So there were a bunch of different reasons to move to the second generation product. First, it was getting harder and harder from a commercial point of view to manufacture both autologous patient-derived cells, but also a different mitochondrial batch for each patient. A different mitochondrial batch means every time we had a mother who happened to be anemic, or we didn't get quite enough mitochondria from that mother, it was challenging. It was also challenging to do all of the quality control tests that the FDA asked for on the very small number of mitochondria you can get from a single batch from a mother, right? And also, it meant we just had to stay very close in a very small number of diseases because Pearson syndrome is not inherited, but it didn't enable us to expand to inherited diseases. And the other thing that we saw when we started to look at placenta, which was our target tissue for allogeneic mitochondria, is that placenta-derived mitochondria have a higher copy number, they have higher activity, so they seem to be even a better product to begin with relative to blood-derived mitochondria. And the reason we chose placenta is because it's a very young organ, right? It's 9 months old, it's fresh, it has tons of mitochondria, and it's just discarded. And we just thought it was, a waste to have it as medical waste. And the other interesting aspect of using placenta or any allogeneic mitochondrial product for mitochondrial augmentation was that we could now track the persistence of that mitochondrial DNA in preclinical studies or in the clinic, which was important from a mechanistic point of view to understand how the product works. So, what are the implications of moving from the use of syngeneic mitochondria to allogeneic mitochondria? It let us expand to additional diseases that are not inherited, which I think is important for the broader primary mitochondrial community. It let us ask questions of, do we need to match mitochondria between donor and recipient, right? In that first generation product, we were just matching between the mother and the patient, but we were now able to ask about matching. And from the point of view of any patient that was previously treated with MNV101, that product was discontinued, but they could receive MNV201. Okay, and we've demonstrated that in the clinic. So what does MNV201 look like? It's exactly, I hope you can see from the slide, it's exactly the same process as previously. The only difference is that we're now thawing mitochondria from a cryopreserved bank, and we don't need to go to the patient's mother each time, right? So if you have adult patients, or if you have patients without a mother or whose mother can't donate for whatever reason, we can do that. And since I get asked this question frequently, it does not need to be the patient's mother getting pregnant, having a placenta, and donating that for the patient. So this is an off-the-shelf, we've got a bank of, I do like this, a bank. It's not there, it's in a liquid nitrogen. This bank of placenta-derived mitochondria, and we know how to match them with the patients so that we can track the mitochondria in the patients. So the first thing we did is go back to Pearson syndrome, right? We saw efficacy and safety with MNV101. Does that look the same in Pearson syndrome with the second generation product, right? Any scientist knows that if you're doing an experiment, you don't want to change two parameters at once. So if I'm changing the mitochondria, I don't want to change the disease at the same time. And we really wanted to see that MNV201 is still safe and is still efficacious in Pearson syndrome patients. So I'm sharing with you now data looking at the height-SDS, comparing it with natural history from a trial that's now ongoing in Israel. So it's a phase two trial. So this is, ongoing work. But what we see if we look at the patient as his own control before and after treatment, we saw in three of the four patients, if we look 3 months before versus 3 months after, we're seeing improvement. If we look 6 months before and 6 months after, we're seeing improvement in one of the two patients for whom we have 6 months post-treatment. And these other two patients that are responders and they seem to be doing good, we just don't have 6 months data yet. So it seems to be promising at this stage. We did actually have one patient drop off out of follow-up. And I would want to stress, since there's a big patient community listening, coming to the follow-ups And I totally understand the challenges, especially of international travel with, this patient population. It's really challenging, but if we can't track improvement and safety, then it's really difficult to support regulatory approvals. And I think that's important for the entire patient community. From a safety perspective, I think it's important to look both at MNV101 and MNV201. Overall, both of the products have a really promising safety profile. I wanted to give you two definitions. This is going to be regulatory speak for a minute so that you can understand what I'm going to talk about in a minute. There's a regulatory definition of what a serious adverse event is, and it's basically any undesirable experience with use of a product. They might be things that are life-threatening. They might be things that require hospitalization that can lead to, disability or any permanent damage. And of course, death is considered a serious adverse event. And it's somewhat confusing because they can be mild. They don't have to be severe. So hospitalization for a mild condition is considered a mild SAE. The other critical piece is a definition of what's related to treatment. So you can have an SAE that's definitely related to treatment. So, for example, we know in our Pearson syndrome population that when we do the apheresis process, you get hypocalcemia, you get a little bit of the ions in the blood are kind of marked. And we know now to deal with that, and that's transient, but we know that's related to the treatment. It has nothing to do with the mitochondria because it's during the apheresis product before the mitochondria have been even introduced to the patients. But that would be an adverse event. It's not serious. That's definitely related to treatment. An unrelated event would be something like, I got hit by a piano falling from the sky and required hospitalization. That has nothing to do with the treatment, but I have to report it as a serious adverse event. So what do we see with Pearson syndrome? The SAEs that are related or possibly related to treatment. There were a couple of patients with SAEs that were related to treatment around the apheresis, so not around drug product infusion. We didn't have any SAEs related to treatment there. And they were all transient. So things that the physician, so Alad knows how to deal with that now because he knows to expect it. The only thing SAE that we had that was possibly related to treatment because we can't rule it out is we did have a patient with lymphocytic leukemia. This was a very young patient. She was 2 years old at treatment. And we had a big meeting with physicians to discuss whether that might be related to treatment, that might not be related to treatment, and we don't know. So I think it's important to call that out. We looked to see if there was anything funny going on with mitochondrial DNA inserting itself into the genome or so forth. Nothing of that sort happened. So we, I think, I was really proud of us. I think that we talked to everybody and we looked for every possible thing that we could explain, but we can't rule out that it was related to treatment. The other important thing is that we never detected any abnormal levels of anti-mitochondrial antibodies in the patient's bloodstream. So we get asked a lot, especially with respect to the allogeneic mitochondrial products, so MNV201, is there any chance that it's going to be immunogenic? Is it going to cause an immune response? And the answer is so far no. Including in patients that we've redosed. So there have been patients that got a second dose of allogeneic mitochondria, and there's absolutely no anti-mitochondrial antibodies detected at any time point that we tested. Maybe two last slides, and then I'll leave time for questions. We do have, in addition to Pearson syndrome, another trial that's now been running in a phase one study. So we treated a total of 26 patients to date with the two products. Most of them with Pearson syndrome, a couple of them with compassionate use, as I showed you in KSS and Leigh syndrome. But as we started to think about what other indications we can move into, we noted that low-risk myelodysplastic syndrome had a couple of interesting connections with Pearson syndrome. One thing that was present was that sideroblastic anemia was known to be in Pearson syndrome patients and also in a subset of myelodysplastic syndrome patients. And maybe more interestingly, there was a large subset of Pearson syndrome patients that actually had myelodysplastic syndrome. Now, myelodysplastic syndrome in the general population is a disease of the aging. So it happens when you're 60 or 70 or 80. And it's extremely rare in a pediatric population. So it made us think that myelodysplastic syndrome might be a disease that's associated with mitochondrial dysfunction. And I won't go into MDS in too much detail. But we did start a clinic. We did a lot of preclinical work to show that mitochondrial, that a MDS is potentially associated with mitochondrial dysfunction, and b that MAT might improve that in both in vitro and in vivo assays. And then we went into a clinical trial in MDS. I do want to share with you some of the data supporting MDS as a potential mitochondrial disease, because the markers there are relevant for the primary mitochondrial disease population as a whole. So we developed a set of mitochondrial biomarkers of content and function, both with the Israeli Innovation Authority and a consortium of researchers there, and now supported by Count On for a Cure. And we can see that many of the mitochondrial markers that we're looking at show that MDS patients have dysfunction relative to their age match controls. So if you look at the heteroplasmy levels, so mitochondrial DNA mutations in MDS patients, they're large, more than you would expect in the age match controls. GDF15 is one of the classical biomarkers looked at in primary mitochondrial disease. Rebecca Ganetsky's paper looks at that in Pearson and KSS syndrome patients, and it's extremely high. And we actually find that in most of our MDS patients, it's extremely high. And we developed a mitochondrial disease score, a mitoscore, and a glycolytic score based on ATP content and electron transport chain and copy number of patients. And you can see that the MDS patients are different from the healthy donors. And this is all work still in progress, but it kind of persuaded us that MDS or a subset of MDS patients might have mitochondrial dysfunction. And the reason I'm showing you this in the context of kind of a mainly primary mitochondrial disease discussion is because we're using these biomarkers to now track patients before and after treatment. So if you think about height SDS as a measure, height is not something that's going to change every day, right? It takes a while to gain centimeters in growth. And developing mitochondrial biomarkers helps us track patients over time. We could do that monthly, hopefully. So we're looking at that to track patients, and we're looking at that to stratify patients for future clinical trials. So we believe that if you can see mitochondrial dysfunction in the bloodstream, then it makes sense that potentially a treatment modality where you fix mitochondrial functionality in the hematopoietic stem cells may cause improvement in the patient population. So what's next for MNV201? For Pearson syndrome, the phase two study is still ongoing in Israel. Four of the patients were recruited. I showed you their initial data. And we're still looking to recruit two more patients. We have a natural history study design that we've been working on with the CHOP, and we're starting to discuss with the FDA, with the point of approving height SDS as an endpoint for the pivotal study. So the FDA said 100% height SDS is clinically objective, but prove to us that it's clinically meaningful. And so it's that showing that it has correlation with the organ involvement is something that we'll be doing now. Because the clinical trial will be looking at the height SDS before versus the height SDS after treatment, those patients that are going to be involved in the natural history study, that data can then be their before data for a pivotal trial where we start to treat them. So we're going to be treating patients that were enrolled in the natural history study. And we're talking about the design of the pivotal trial as well with the FDA. So those are kind of our regulatory challenges for the next bit. And of course, we do plan to do technology transfer pending funding to the US, because we do eventually want to be able to treat Pearson syndrome patients in the US as well as in Israel. MDS, I told you, we're doing a phase one study that's ongoing in Israel. So this is very preliminary work, trying to get a feel for which patients we can treat best with myelodysplastic syndrome. And then we're always continuing to develop the biomarkers so that we can track patients on a more routine basis and decide which other patients we might be able to treat with MNV201. So with that, I just want to thank funding agencies that have supported us throughout the year, preclinical collaborators, which we really can't do all of the science without all of the academics that are kind of supporting. And of course, the different hospitals that we've been working with, the clinicians, and I don't have an image for the patients and the patients' families, but they're front and center in anything we do. So thank you all, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much. There's so much to unpack there, but I really love how you walked us through the trials and the endpoints and explain to us why you guys are using height and like and the implications of that. I think that's just really important and helpful as a patient community to understand just even that entire process of how you go through thinking about clinical trials and trying to find endpoints and just seeing that methodology is super, super helpful. We've definitely had a number of questions come in. And so first I just I'm curious because you talked about these two different technologies, kind of like a 1.0 and a 2.0. Is the thought that the second generation will replace the first, like if that goes well?
So it's actually already replaced the first. So we had to, this was the decision making that we had to do because we can't, as a very small startup company, support development of two products. At some stage, we had to discontinue the first generation product. So we're no longer providing that. Everything transitioned to second generation. And I'm happy to say that it seems to be as safe and efficacious as the first generation product. I think that was a question that was in everybody's mind. Will allogeneic mitochondria function just as well? Will there be immunological reactions? That was the same pushback that we kept getting from, physicians and the FDA. They were concerned about that. And so I think we've persuaded ourselves and the clinicians and the community just from the clinical data that that's not an issue.
Do you know why that there isn't immunological responses, or do you have guys have theories that you can share about that at this point?
Two things I think are involved in that. One is that the fact that we're doing ex vivo mitochondrial augmentation. So we are taking the mitochondria and putting them into cells. But if you think about it, and then we extensively wash out any non-internalized mitochondria from the cells before reinfusing back into patients. So what the patient is actually seeing is their own cells, right? They're not getting a bunch of exogenous mitochondria dumped into their blood system. So that's one reason. The second reason, and I didn't go into it in this talk because I was concerned it might get too scientific, but I'm happy to answer questions about that. From a mechanistic point of view, when we first started doing MAT, we thought that the exogenous mitochondria would persist over time, so that it would be kind of like a gene therapy where you would get persistence of that and then they could take over the cell and transfer to other organs and you'll fix everything. Biology is more complicated than that. And what we see is that there's no persistence of the exogenous mitochondrial DNA over time. So what happens is the exogenous mitochondria goes into the cell and causes a homeostasis, like kind of a recycling of mitochondria. It promotes mitobiogenesis, so production of additional mitochondria, and it promotes mitophagy, getting rid of the bad mitochondria. But also the mitochondria that we put in are lost over time, over a relatively short period of time, so that they're not there anymore to exert an immune reaction. So,
So it might be a blessing in disguise that you kind of have to go
absolutely.
back to get more in order for it to be persistent. That's
Right.
interesting.
Yeah. And then the question became from, can we redose was a really important question because if you look at gene therapy fields, so when you can only get a single dose of anything with AAV because then you're going to start to get an immune reaction. We have already redosed with the FDA's permission a patient. So when we first submitted the clinical trial design to the FDA, we asked for redosing and they said, we want it patient by patient to okay it. And so when we first started dosing the patients, we dosed a few patients and then we came back to the FDA and asked to redose a patient with all of the data from the different patients. And then they agreed. And we still have not seen an immunological response. So we're very confident that there is no immune response, but it was, we did it really safely and stepwise to make sure that we're not going to do any harm.
I love the careful steps that you're taking and also just and how you're able to explain that. I think that's just really, really helpful to kind of see the entire process. We did have a question that came in regards to MAT treatment available for adults with secondary mitochondrial dysfunction, which I know you hit a little bit on that t towards the end. But they asked, when will MAT treatment be available for adults with secondary mitochondrial dysfunction? How would you answer something like that?
It's complicated because it depends what secondary mitochondrial dysfunction. And I think one of the driving forces for doing the biomarker development was to say, who can we treat? What are the best targets? Because we would love to treat everybody, right? I think we all, as we age, and you can see my hair is getting grayer, we all have mitochondrial dysfunction. I mean, that's just a part of life. And if you think about, I don't know, blue sky, vision is we can treat every one of us with mitochondrial augmentation, maybe jumpstart our mitochondria. So I think the way to go about it very logically and stepwise is say, who shows severe mitochondrial dysfunction in their bloodstream? That's the patient population that I would treat first with MAT. So when we saw those biomarkers, and that's why I wanted to show that in this talk, that persuaded us to treat MDS. If we had, a different acquired mitochondrial disorder, I would test that in the bloodstream first and see if you could see indication of mitochondrial dysfunction there. That might be another target. But it's slow going.
So I like how you kind of siphoned out that you have to, you're focusing on the Pearson syndrome first, that you couldn't necessarily tackle Pearson-Lee's KSS. But do you see a trajectory at this point of some of those other conditions? And then there was a patient, I'm just going to kind of tack this in there. There was a patient that asked, like when this therapy gets approved, how do you just like, how does the cost situation work out? How do you figure that out? And
How does the what situation? I'm sorry.
the cost, the
Oh.
cost. Like how, like what is the brainstorming around that? Or, insurance companies, like is the goal for them to cover it? I would hope so, but like how does that work?
I mean, the goal is to get insurance companies to cover it, of course, for the patients. I can't say we know what the cost will look like. And I do know that some of these rare cell therapy drugs are costing, hundreds and thousands and millions. I do not know what that will look like in the end. That will definitely be discussion. We are adding to our clinical protocols assessments of patient quality of life as secondary endpoints. And part of that is to persuade. So when we think about a clinical trial, we look at what the regulator is looking for, height SDS, right? But if I go to a reimbursement agency and say, oh, I changed his height, he's going to be like, so what? So we are adding parameters of number of hospitalizations and quality of life and things like that that will hopefully support getting reimbursement from the insurance companies. But we're not quite there yet with respect to where we are and discussions on costing.
So another patient said, "Thank you so much for your inspiring work. Is there any more work that can be done to see if this treatment might cause leukemia? And are there plans to expand testing among the KSS patients? What do you expect to work on in the next 1, 3, 5 years?"
Okay, the leukemia part, and we're obviously tracking that closely, but it was a very single incident. When we moved into MDS, the biggest concern was so M my MDS is a pre-leukemic condition, and it can transition to AML. And the biggest concern was might we accelerate that transition? And then we definitely do not want to go there. Actually, in the clinical trial for Pearson syndrome, patients with myelodysplastic syndrome was an exclusion criteria because we were so concerned about that initially. When we started to do work on MDS, what we saw in collaboration with Dr. Omer Abdelwahab from Memorial Sloan Kettering, he did mitochondrial augmentation on his mouse model in his own hands, with his postdoc, which I love because it was an external validation of the technology. And he saw that the mice that have the MDS the fusion gene die after about a month from a transition to AML. The mice that received mitochondrial augmentation survived to about 4 or 5 months. So we got an increase in survival and a delay of the progression to leukemia. So it was actually, improved survival. We were actually so shocked by the result that we repeated it. We thought it was too good to be true, but it actually repeated itself. So, something good is going on there. So we don't think that we're causing anything that can cause a progression to leukemia, but it's something that we always follow, the safety of the patients. And that's always first and foremost in our minds. With respect to the second part of that question, where are we going next? KSS, et cetera. We would have loved to do the clinical trial in Pearson and KSS together. And the reason we couldn't is because the progression of that height SDS parameter, which was really the only parameter we could think of that the agency would agree to as both clinically meaningful and clinically objective, just progresses too slowly with KSS. So we don't think we can track it in a timeframe that is reasonable for clinical studies. And that's why we're continuing to treat patients under compassionate use, but we can't do the clinical trial for KSS at this time. One of the reasons we've been developing the biomarkers is with the hope that at some stage they can become surrogate endpoints for accelerated approval for additional indications, which would, and then I can track KSS patients for 10 years and see a very slow improvement in height SDS. or in some other parameter that we can agree on with the agency, but we could use those blood-based biomarkers to accelerate some of the development in additional disease spaces. So I can't promise anything. We're trying to be really creative about, being able to get this technology to as many patients as possible, but that's where the thinking is right now.
That's super helpful. And there was like some questions that came in too about heteroplasty. So I'm wondering if we can like step back and talk about this technology and nuclear DNA versus mitochondrial DNA and your thoughts about the efficacy of those different places. And if it can impact heteroplasty of a mitochondrial condition.
Right. So, 2 points to that. When we first started, again, as I said, we thought it was going to be kind of a gene therapy approach. And that was why we were very focused on mitochondrial DNA mutations and deletions only. So, it was Lee syndrome patients with mitochondrial DNA involvement, it was deletions, Pearson and KSS. There were a lot of preclinical studies coming out, and there was a discussion of what's more important, heteroplasmy or copy number. Is it the heteroplasmy level, or is it just have enough copy number to get enough full-length copies there? What we're seeing so far, both with MNV101 and MNV201, is a rise in copy number, more than an effect on heteroplasmy. So we think that's more critical, but we're tracking both. And as we move into the additional indications, so like myelodysplastic syndrome, we're also looking at copy number changes in myelodysplastic syndrome, which seem to be trending the same direction. And myelodysplastic syndrome, by the way, has nuclear mutations. So it's like any other kind of pre-leukemic or cancer where you start getting random genetic mutations. We're not fixing those, but I think we're shifting the balance from a point of view of mitochondrial functionality. So we don't yet know if we can treat all, nuclear mitochondrial dysfunctions. We're definitely not going to be fixing the root cause, right? So if you've got a Pol G mutation, I'm not going to fix it. You're still going to have that Pol G mutation in the genome, or TFAM, or what have you. But we can maybe improve functionality to some extent. But that's what, that's when we're kind of trying to select which diseases we think we have the best chance of impact. Those are kind of the questions that we're asking ourselves each step of the way.
That's super helpful. Do you think this could be used for diseases like MRF, or are there other diseases that you guys are thinking about outside of KSS and Lee syndrome and MDS right now?
Yeah, so MRF and MELAS and all of the different mitochondrial DNA mutations, I think yes. I think we need to look at them, one by one again from the point of view of what endpoint makes sense within a reasonable time frame from a clinical standpoint. And also, one of the benefits, I guess, from point of view of a very small company of Pearson syndrome is that we can do trials in small number of patients and hopefully get approvals. When we look into larger patient populations of MELAS and MRF, it would just mean treating more patients, which becomes more challenging from an economic standpoint for a small startup company. But it's definitely where we think we will want to be going. And I think we can improve functionality in those patient populations as well.
What U.S. locations do you expect this work could be conducted in? Is that too big of a question to ask right
It's a
now?
reasonable question. We have a many years of collaboration with the CHOP, so I'm definitely hopeful that we would be able to work with the CHOP in a clinical trial. We're looking at a couple of different places where we can do a technology transfer to, so that requires all of the cell therapy infrastructure, right? But I think once we're sitting somewhere in the US, we can ship product to multiple locations, right? So the product takes 72 hours. We have a stability on the product of 48 hours. So once we manufacture the product, anywhere it can get to the patient within 48 hours, we're good to go. And if you think about the US, if I have a manufacturing site in, Boston or New York or Philadelphia or what have you, I can ship that to California in 48 hours. So it becomes less of a limitation for treating anywhere in the States.
That's so exciting.
Yeah.
Right, so another person said, "Thank you, Dr. Noah, for the insightful talk. I have one question regarding biomarker selection. Since over 90% of mitochondrial disease genes are actually encoded by the nuclear genome, is your biomarker selection approach based on nuclear encoded mitochondrial genes or those encoded by the mitochondrial genome, which contains only 13 protein coded genes?" Which I think you kind of answered before, but I wanted to ask the question in case there's other things you wanted to add.
Right. So the biomarkers we're developing, the ones that have to do with mitochondrial DNA mutations are definitely mitochondria oriented, and we're not sequencing the whole genome at this stage. It's just too cost prohibitive. But all of the activity assays, so looking at ATP and looking at the electron transport, so complex one and complex two activity and so forth, that will show dysfunction irrespective of whether the mutation was mitochondrial or nuclear. And we did, I mentioned it briefly, but we did recently receive a very generous grant from Countdown from a Cure for a Cure that helps us further develop the mitochondrial biomarkers. And I think we're going to be seeing a second generation of those as we proceed forward. So we'll be doing more. But I don't think there's a difference between nuclear and mitochondrial.
So there was a follow-up question about the immune implications. They asked, is there any matching or selection process between the placental mitochondria and patient mitochondria?
Okay, I forgot to address that. So, yes and no. We don't think from any in vitro, in vivo, or any work we've seen in the patients to date that there is a requirement from the point of view of either safety or efficacy. So, in the tox study, we intentionally chose mitochondria that were far apart to kind of mimic a potential worst case scenario. When we look at an in vitro assay that looks at erythroid differentiation potential, if you match close or if you match really, really far, you get the same improvement of mitochondrial augmentation. Similarly, we have an in vivo assay where we look at the potential of cells to engraft and reconstitute in the bone marrow and reconstitute the bloodstream before with or without MAT. And it's identical if you have close matching or further matching. So I don't think we need matching for either safety or efficacy. The reason I think that is because there's no long-term persistence of the mitochondria, so it really doesn't make a difference. But again, this is, work in progress, and the data from humans will decide, right? So this is no promises. The one thing we do is we definitely make sure that there is at least a couple of SNPs differences, a couple of single nucleotide differences between the donor and the recipient, so that we can track persistence, because I think that's critical to be able to answer some of these mechanistic questions over time. So all of the quality control standard operating procedures necessitate a given number of differences between the donor and the recipient so that we are able to track with the methodologies we're using. We're using, state-of-the-art Illumina and nanopore methods to determine the difference.
I really appreciate your willingness to like share with us the information at the time and like recognizing that, we are the data as the patient community and that this can change over time. But it's really helpful to kind of know where the meaningful data is right now. And we'll continue to come back to you in the future to see where the data is a year from now, or 2 years from now. Because it's this new technology is ever changing, and which is exciting, but of course there's going to be kind of some blips and lots of questions in the process. So there's a patient that asked kind of like a more, I think a more general question, because you mentioned a little bit about mitochondria and the bone marrow. And so they were curious about that, like, and what that looks like with mitochondria and the bone marrow. And then I think they heard you talk a lot about anemia with this patient population. And are you familiar whether or not anemia is an overarching issue with a number of different mitochondrial patients, or is it specific to Pearson? Did you see it in your other like KSS patients and Leigh syndrome?
Great question, and I'm so happy for the different questions, because it's like all of those reminders of things I should have mentioned and didn't. So thank you. We not definitely not all primary mitochondrial diseases have anemia associated with them. So Leigh syndrome is more cognitive, right? And MLS has stroke-like episodes and so forth. And I think that's one of the challenges of basketing them in a single trial. They're all so different, right? And Pearson syndrome are kind of a worst case scenario where really almost all of the organ systems have the mitochondrial deletion and the phenotype, but different diseases have different spectrum of phenotypes. I do suspect that many mitochondrial diseases have involvement of mitochondrial dysfunction in the immune system. So if you see Leigh syndrome patients, physicians will give them IgGs, so immunoglobulins, and that seems to improve them. And initially nobody knew why, right? It's a cognitive disease, it's a neuro disease. So there seems to be, and there are researchers researching this all the time recently. So if you went to the United the UMDF, the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation sessions 5 years ago, nobody was talking about immune function of mitochondria. In the last round, there was a whole session on immune function of mitochondria. So I think there's more and more awareness of mitochondrial functionality importance in the bone marrow, in the immune cells. But it's definitely not the same phenotype for every primary mitochondrial disease, and not every, patient population with primary mitochondrial disease involvement has definitely not had anemia, and not always it's going to be immune involvement. I actually just want to, you mentioned the me sharing the challenges of things as we go along. I think that's one of the things that for me, I've been in the cell therapy space about a decade. That was the most shocking to begin with, because I came in as a scientist, I was used to doing experiments by the bench, and you change one parameter and you optimize and you optimize. And then realizing that you're going into drug development, you come in with a product that you don't fully understand, and it's going to change as you go. And that's part of the process, because and that involves some level of risk taking from the company, and definitely from the patients and the caregivers. And that's implied in the process, because you can't learn about the product without, eventually treating patients in a way that's safe, and in a way that's, doing everything in your mind to take care of safety first. But we learn things as we go along, and there are products out there that have been approved, and nobody has a clue mechanistically how they work, but they work. And I think that's most important for the patient population. But I think that's an appreciation that, I've grown to appreciate over time, that, you're learning as you go along, and you're improving the product. You're improving all of the quality control around the product, you're improving the process around the product, you're improving understanding, everything as it goes along.
So, we started off our session. Before we started the session, I asked you what would be questions that you would ask. And so I want to end maybe with one of those questions about what differentiates what you're doing versus direct mitochondrial transplantation.
So I mentioned, I think in the beginning, we do ex vivo mitochondrial transplantation. When Natalie, the CEO, and my very good friend and benchmate for my PhD 20 odd years ago, I stopped counting after 20. When she first started the company, her original vision was, let's just inject them into, it was just inject them IV and they'll go where they need to go. Kind of this holistic view of, they'll go where there's, damage in the body. And as we kind of grew and matured, we said there's no way to track where they go. It's impossible in my mind to make a pure mitochondrial product, because mitochondria in a cell are these hubs, and they bind every single organelle. And so when you manufacture them, in my mind, you can't make them pure, because if you make them pure, you're kind of peeling out the outer layer, everything that's touching everything else. So, and that's something we've had discussions with the FDA about. They're aware of that. But I think that's the biggest differentiator, that we're doing ex vivo mitochondrial transplantation. So everything happens outside of the body in a very controlled manner, and doing all of the quality control. I think the jury's still out on the whole mitochondrial transplantation field. I think there are amazing studies. So John Brestoff had an amazing paper recently on Leigh syndrome mice models. So there seem to be improvements. I don't think the mechanism is understood at all. I don't know if it has to do with functional mitochondria or mitochondria that have ruptured, and it's something in those mitochondria that is having an effect. I don't know if it has to do with an effect on immune system or not. But I think that's one of the biggest differentiators. I'm really excited by that field, because I think, we'll be learning more and more. And just as we're learning, with mitochondrial augmentation technology, I think we'll be learning a lot about the direct mitochondrial transplantation field as we move forward. So it's a space to watch. Be happy to have a follow-up discussion on that.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I think it's important just for families and people to know that these are two different technologies, because sometimes it's easy to kind of like combine them in your head. So I wanted to kind of dispel that myth a little bit too, but just, remind families that there's so much excitement. There's so many new things that are going on, and there's so many questions that are being asked. And we just really appreciate all the questions that you're asking, because and advancing the science for our community. And we just really, really appreciate you taking the time today to share with us all the wonderful things that you guys are doing at Manovia, and we look forward to hearing more in the future and working collaboratively and just with updates and stuff. So thank you so much for being here and answering all of our questions. We really appreciate it.
I mean, we're here for you guys. That's why we wake up in the morning. So it's a pleasure.
Well, thank you to our audience. Thank you for everybody that's coming and all the questions that you asked. And we look forward to seeing everyone again soon.
Bye.
Bye.